أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين سيدنا ومولانا وقائدنا وشفيعنا محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله وبركاته
جزاك الله خير for joining us Inshallah we have another discussion today
Inshallah
centered around the point around navigating the left and right divide at the moment as we've seen recently, we had Trump's mugshot come out. That's obviously has
fired up the support.
Fired up the support base. Just yesterday, I saw a particular interview on the streets when he was taking his mugshot. An ABC reporter went and sought the opinion of a particular Trump supporter. And she proclaimed that the America is being taken over by the communists. And obviously that has some kind of historical context to it as well. But that raises the point, right? And if we can discuss these particular issues, that there is this impassioned politics between the two sides. And what position should the Muslims take, if anything at all, on this particular point? What's going on? Why is there certain trends that are occurring throughout history? We see, I suppose people, if we take that opinion from that particular person on the street to heart, that it seems like it's going more towards the left, more towards the communist type of ideal, as she put it. Why it's occurring? What's going on? And who's going to win in all of this at the end of the day?
They're quite important questions, and they're not easy to answer, to be honest. There's a lot of noise out there, a lot of passion, as you describe. And whilst we witness the similar trends happening in Australia, I don't think we have the same level of intensity as it's demonstrated in other countries, specifically in Europe and specifically in America. Certainly those trends are being exported to Australia. The dynamics of the politics and what it entails is exported globally, and it's going to affect Australia as much as anyone else. But it's important to make sense of it. You raise some very important points. There are alarming trends that are happening across entire Western societies. These are going to play out not just inside those countries, but on the world stage. They have direct implications, not just for Western societies, but for the world at large. And I think from the Muslim perspective, there are a lot of issues we need to get our heads around, because sometimes it seems a little overwhelming that there is so much going on. There are so many arguments being presented. There are so many perspectives being challenged. And it's happening so fast and so quickly and of such a large force that often we don't know where we should position ourselves in respect to all of this. So it's easy to dismiss Trump, for instance, as a buffoon. Right, it's very easy to do that, but it's not easy to dismiss what he represents and what he's come to represent.
That's because a person can claim, obviously, that those particular emotions or sentiments were there long before Trump. So it's not just because Trump's come to power or certain right-wing politicians in Europe has come to power.
He's riding the wave. Mm. And we know Trump as a personality, he'll sell anything to anyone as long as it benefits him. And he has no religious base. His entire existence is anti-religious, but he's tapped into a market like he has in his business dealings.
And he's proven to be a real force at the moment, right? Because he's absolutely smashing the opinion polls in the Republican side of things.
Despite everything that's happening to him.
Exactly.
And of course, he's been presented as a martyr for the cause.
So what's going on there though, right? So why is he so popular? Right, like because this gives us back down to the point of a particular politics or a particular sentiment in the base.
Correct.
Where's that come from? And it seems like things have happened to Western society over the years that has really agitated a certain section.
A very large section. Yeah. How far back do you want to go?
Let's go back to where we all started, right? Back to the days of the church,
You know, for us. Yeah. If I could use the expression youngins, and I use that very loosely, we may not be privy to the historical divides in Western society. And we haven't lived in an era where for instance, where you didn't live in the era of the Cold War. We didn't live in an era where religious institutions played a much more active and central role in society. In the last few decades, we've had almost the complete secularization of society, the almost complete decentering of God in life, practically, political life, even personal life. We've seen trends, for instance, in this country, in other Western societies, the gradual decline of religious affiliation when the census comes out consistently.
Yeah, so on that, I had some figures earlier that from the 70s, Australia...
quite religious.
Yeah, still very religious. They had about 86% identified as being Christian. So
everyone attached themselves to a religious...
Yeah, so now it's down to like 43%.
That's right. And the opposite is happening.
Yes.
The percentage of those that don't ascribe to a particular religion...
is much
or
higher.
Regard themselves agnostics or atheists, and convert. And from the other side, the rise of other religions through migration or natural birth. So the role of religious institutions and the role of religion in general has been gradually declining in
Particularly in West, right? Yeah.
Particularly in the West. Our experience in the Muslim world...
Yeah, it's a little bit different, right?
...is very different. If you look at the popular figures in the Muslim world, they always tend to be religious figures.
100%. And there was, you know... a particular survey that's always quoted a few years ago where a percentage of around about 76% of people wanted strict Sharia law being implemented in the countries, in certain countries.
And that's replicated census after census, study after study. But let's go back to your question. Your question is, where did all this come from? Why does the passion exist? And why is there so much tension such that we feel in places like America it could implode at any point? There was an onslaught on the Congress, trying to overrun democratic institutions, trying to disrupt them by force. These are unprecedented events in our time. Obviously, America was born on that tradition. In other Western societies in Europe, it was born on violent revolutions. But we've been very comfortable for a long time because of the total domination of secular politics. So we haven't seen the level of tension that we're seeing now. And so it's brought to the fore underlying tensions and divides in Western societies that have always been there. And yet the sensitivities of various sides have been so pressed that they felt a need to reemerge much more, not just violently, but much more publicly, much more assertively, because they feel their very existence is under threat. Themselves and what they represent, their underlying values. And this comes back to, I joke about how far you want to go back, but we really, to put everything in context, you have to go back to the development of enlightenment in Western societies, in European societies. And in that way, without getting bogged down in the philosophical details, the essence of enlightenment in Europe was the desire to break free from two things, religious dogma, blind faith, and religious persecution. And a lot of the proponents of enlightenment, and this is an important point because it's often forgotten, were very religious themselves. And it's not that they were in principle opposed to God, for instance, or in principle opposed to religious value or religion playing an active role in their life, personal or political. It's just they were not content with, to put it very mildly, the degree of overreach of what became known as religious institutions and the corruption and the persecution that was synonymous with absolute power that they enjoyed.
And it was the domination of a certain type of Christianity over
correct.
Other
and so other Christians themselves were being oppressed. It's not just non-Christians were being oppressed. So it was the assault on the mind and on the body that they wanted to free themselves. Yeah, there was a segment amongst the population of Enlightenment thinkers that wanted to do away with the church completely and wanted to do away with the concept of God. And they are historical figures that are very, very pronounced in Western tradition. But by and large, religion in Western societies, that even though historically it was encapsulated in the existence of religious institutions and in religious life, And the values that emerge from that within families, within traditions, within societies, those underlying currents never dissipated. They never went away. It's just they changed form. So you will find, for instance, we know this in the Australian context and broadly, more broadly in the Western context, that you'll have non-Muslims who would not necessarily identify themselves as being overtly religious, but they subscribe to an underlying set of values that have their historical roots in Christianity, around family, around gender roles, around notions of sexuality and things like that. Very conservative values that historically are rooted in Christian Europe.
And which reminds me of a question in the citizenship test, which was brought out many years ago. And actually, at the time, Tony Abbott was asked on one of the shows the answer of a particular question, which was, what is the Australian system based upon? Now, he said that the correct answer is Judeo-Christian history.
That's right.
But I believe it's a secular institution.
That's right.
So,
and the thing is, yeah. Both of them are right.
Yeah.
This is the point. Both of them are right. But things have morphed so significantly that what's been naturalized as normal Western values, if I could use that expression, for a large part are historically Christian values. And if we want to be politically correct, we say Judeo-Christian, if we want to excuse and turn a blind eye to the historical persecution of Jews in Europe. And so you will have non-religious types in Western society, which, as you describe, are dominant, the dominant feature, but still subscribe to an overriding set of conservative values, even though they may not necessarily go to church every Sunday, and they may not necessarily respect the institution of the church, but still respect religion, or respect the benefit of religious tradition and its effect in the construction of Western society. So we have these currents at play, and historically, the reconciliation between the two extremes was somewhere in the middle, where we accept the role of tradition, but we limit the overreach of religious institutions. So they created new political institutions like the parliament and other secular courts and things like that, that in principle were supposed to remain neutral in the religious space, but in reality just carried with them underlying values which they inherited, but imposed their own variation of that.
Yeah, for sure. And plus, obviously, over time, there's going to be scope creep from
correct
one side or the other, right?
And there's a constant tussle.
Yeah, 100%.
There's a constant tussle between the two. Mm. And I think from an Australian perspective, we don't realise how deep this divide is. Mm. If we take America, for instance, as an example, this historical divide is deep and it's still in existence, that the historical divide between North and South in America. Mm-hmm. America was founded upon religious foundations, and those religious traditions were entrenched in the Constitution, even if they were described in different ways. And how institutions progressed and how society progressed in America relied very heavily and centered religious tradition. And for a large part of America's existence, it was a very conservative country, and still by many measures is still regarded as a very conservative country. But what has conservative come to mean, of course, is, you know, its bastardization in a secular way, but it doesn't detract from its underlying roots. And this comes back to the point about what Trump has tapped into, that you'll find in America, for instance, very strong opinions on gun control, on abortion and family life and gender role and notions of sexuality and whatnot. And it's funny because often as Muslims, as observers of this, we think we just come out of 20 years of the war on terror, and we're still, you know, experience the realities of historical Western military intervention in the Muslim world. And we imagine, sometimes we fantasize that our very existence as Muslims in the West is so fragile and so under threat that at any moment there could be a genocide against us. But the truth is, the left and the right hate each other so much more than they will hate anyone else. And these sentiments are so deep and so real.
It's because there's a real history there, right?
There's a real
history. It was a violent history.
And it plays out.
It was the reign of terror actually started within Europe. So after,
correct,
after the French Revolution.
Correct. And like you bring that point up.
Yeah.
But it's a tradition that the West like to conveniently forget or overlook, mm-hmm. that there is no other tradition in Western society except violence and tyranny and persecution of all its variations. And then they exported that to the world. Mm. But because they became so dominant, they could afford to pretend to themselves in their own constituents that they represent something else. And they were hoping that people would have a short memory and think, okay, we've morphed into something more civilized.
And it's easy, and it's a lot easier for them to do during peacetime, because everyone's comfortable. You can start changing
their... Peace for who? That's the point. Peace for who?
In their own countries, right?
Within their own countries, relatively speaking. Mm. But in the rest of the world...
Yeah, for sure. They're,
we've only known Western violence.
Yeah,
we've only known Western violence. There's no other language they speak. And we'll come back to this point, because there's a point that's often forgotten, but it's central to the whole conversation.
Yeah. Just on the point, because you brought up the Raw and Terror era, and I just want to sort of introduce the topic... Around during those 20 years, obviously, the so-called left were a bit more sympathetic to the Muslims at the time, and so it was very easy for the Muslims.
We regarded them as more sympathetic to the Muslim cause.
Right. Yeah, right. And now, for instance, that trend has changed. Now you see some Muslims, for instance, jumping on the bandwagon of all the family issues that we see today.
Right. They feel more threatened by the left.
Yeah, they feel more threatened by the left, and now they seem to be a little bit closer to the right. And that brings us to a point where it seems like, as our existence in the West, we have to be very careful not to be swayed by the particular current of the time, where we are going with the status quo in a certain context. Yes, we're trying to align to certain benefits or certain ideas that we regard as being important to us, but again, we are being swayed by the actual current that's currently in society.
Yeah, you touch on a sensitive point, to be honest, for the Muslim community. It demonstrates a certain level of political thinking, or more accurately, the absence of a certain level of political thinking. From one angle, it's understandable. In many circles, we regard our existence here as a fragile one. And our politics is reflective of an existential crisis, real or imagined. A lot of us come from migrant communities. A lot of us now are born and raised in Western societies. And so we regard our place here in a much more naturalized way, despite all the obstacles that we face. So in one sense, we can be sympathetic to that line of thinking. It's just it's the thinking that is overwhelmed by notions of survival, and just not rocking the boat. Yep. And it's understandable. People come from very traumatic experiences.
And plus, there is an element there of, like, there is an Islamic element there, obviously, because they're trying to have sympathetic feelings towards the side that seems to align a little bit more to Islamic values,
and
right?
That's the second point.
Yeah.
That explains why we've swayed with the times. Mm-hmm. That's short-term thinking, where we become reactive to what's in front of us. There are policy decisions, policy directions in this country, and as you suggest, we seek to align ourselves with those policies that we believe as a community can best serve us as a community, can best protect our interests as a community, which is by and large underlined by religious sentiment. But in the long run,
it's a very limited political vision, isn't it?
It's demonstrated this is a very dangerous way of approaching our politics. And so it demonstrates there's a certain lack of critical political thinking that's rooted in Islamic tradition that can transcend what is immediately in front of us. So we started this whole conversation with the fact that there is so much passion and so much noise. And in one way, like the general society, the community has been overwhelmed by what's in front of them. The forces have been so loud and so strong and so imposing that the war on terror came out of nowhere. And then the onslaught that has a lot of Muslims hesitant today around family values and gender and whatnot seems like it came out of nowhere. You know, it's just switched from one thing to another, even though it doesn't work like that. But the impression is, and so we're constantly backtracking, we're constantly reacting to what's in front of us. And I think for us, there's two things that need to happen here. First of all, we need to resist the temptation to be part of a conversation that may or may not necessarily be ours. We don't have to react to everything.
How? Especially if the basis itself is not Islamic. Especially, yeah, and it's rooted, as you went through the whole history.
Yeah, well, the assumption is not reacting means we give ourselves the time and a space to actually critically engage with what's in front of us before we take a position. And the problem is we're acting without understanding first. And that's why these positions we adopt, whether philosophically, ideologically, or politically, are constantly shifting. It's because we haven't actually taken the time to step back and say, let's make sense of all of this.
What does it mean? What is its basis? What is its foundation?
Let's connect it to its history.
What do they want? What do we want? What does Islam say?
And let's judge it Islamically, purely from an Islamic lens. This conversation is missing.
Yeah. Especially if one was to just understand what the Islamic objective is. Just that. All right? That it prevails over all other ways of life. Just that. Right?
But
that will just shape all your thinking.
The thing is, it seems like an easy exercise to do, but it's a scary one. Mm-hmm. And it's a question that a lot of us like to run away from because we know what the end result is going to be. Mm. It's going to result in some form of confrontation, some form of conflict.
Which is what the Ansar said when they were about to give the bay'ah to...
And they understood it very clearly.
They said that if we're going to give the bay'ah...
It's a declaration.
And go, it's a declaration to not, on the whole
it's
world.
A declaration.
Black and white, everybody.
And that's the question we try to avoid, or we try to be diplomatic about it. But what has that resulted? It's resulted in the gradual withering away of Islamic values, whether under the war on terror, whether under notions of democratic Islam, whether under the notions of pragmatism, or under the notions of pushing certain family values or gender-based conversations. Whichever politics we've swayed towards, it's always come at the expense of our Islam. And the withering away of underlying Islamic values, we are old enough to remember, and we might be revealing a little bit too much about our age, but we're old enough to remember how dominant the conversation was about the notion of compatibility between Islam and democracy. And this was the opinion in vogue, 20 years ago.
Islam is democracy.
The Prophet ﷺ established the first democratic state, that democracy is shura. And time has shown that this argument was so bogus that it was just one of many means employed.
It's just conforming again to the reality at the time.
And that's what's continually
even
playing
now
out.
For instance, like when we see even the impending referendum. Once the government says we want you to adopt this position,
and all
everyone's
of a sudden,
on board.
We're all parodying the view of the government.
Exactly.
There's the complete absence of independent thought and critical engagement with Islam. And that's left us exposed, which is why when we come to the whole issue of left-right divide, conservative values versus more liberal values, conservative politics or liberal politics, our short history in the West has shown us that allying with either side is detrimental to the Islamic cause. Despite the short-term gains or the perceived short-term gains, it comes at enormous long-term cost.
As much as the left will hate this, they are born from the same wound. They come from the same wound at the end of the day. They put the historical philosophical figures and the thinkers... We're just a slight alteration from the previous thinker.
Yeah. Right? The history of colonization, which is relevant to our experience as Muslims. And if we ever forget this, just pick up the phone and speak to your relatives in the Muslim world. Because from our perspective here in the West, we think, oh, maybe some are good, some are bad, some are better meaning, some are worse. Some we can engage with, others can't. And we try to make that distinction between good and bad. But pick up the phone and ask your relatives in the Muslim world, when the West comes with its military machine or its economic sanctions and embargoes, do they stop and ask, hold on, is this a liberal position or a Labour position? A Democratic or a Republican? Consistently of all sides of politics, it's been the same policy applied to the Muslim world and the same policy applied to the Muslim
left
community
right,
in the West.
Right? Left or right. Left it's because right. The motivation now here is where we can start introducing the capitalist side of things. Yes, there's a historic philosophical basis to it. Right? But at the end of the day, it's the merchant class that came into power.
Yeah,
look, they have the power.
And the difference between the two can be summarised very, very easily. The conservatives in general... right? And this is their philosophical tradition, a very dogmatic in approach, supremacist in their view of the world. They look at the rest of the world, including the Muslims, that they are less than human. Their civilization is not worth engaging. I'm going to give them by force what I believe is good for them. And so there's no conception of here I can perhaps rescue Islam and Muslims and reconstruct it in a way that could be more productive from my perspective as a conservative. It's just a force of my way through. Yep. I know what's good for them. I'm going to rob them from what they have and give them what I
have. And if they have to do it alone, they will do it alone.
They will. And that's a
difference.
They have.
That's the difference between left and right, right?
But the left come and say, look, you know what? At the end of the day, they're human, us Muslims. Yep. There's something there in Islam that we can engage with. We want to reconstruct it and enable Muslims to approach the Islam with a secular lens. Correct. But it's something
Let's
we believe
bring him on the
it
ride.
Can be saved. It's something we believe can be they can be saved.
Yep.
That's the only difference between left and right. They both want to change us, but some believe that there's a little bit of hope in us and they could use us, use our Islam to serve their cause.
It's
the other one's
styles.
Not interested in the
it's
conversation. It's a style.
Style to
it's
achieve the same objective.
Approach, but the objective is the same. 100%. That they believe what they have is superior. They look down our Islam. They look at down on our Islamic tradition. And they have no regard for our history, our values, and our ethos, and certainly not our institutions. And so when they engage politically or economically or militarily, the difference is just, like you said, tactics, which is why, for instance, Kevin Rudd always used to bang on about the good war and the bad war, as if what happened in Afghanistan is something we should be proud of, and what happened in Iraq is something we should be embarrassed about. Yeah. But from the Muslim perspective, we're still dying. Our countries are still destroyed. It's just from their perspective. What Kevin Rudd meant is the blowback from Iraq made that whole endeavor counterproductive from the West's perspective.
It's harder.
Not the, that they felt
have
bad.
A harder,
they
have harder, a,
like it,
harder weight
it didn't
to justify
go
the
way they imagined. 100%. So it doesn't serve our purpose.
Yeah.
But Afghanistan did.
But they still achieved certain objectives.
100% they did.
They still got the wealth out of it.
100%
they
did.
They still got the political clout out of it. That reminds me of a particular saying which I was reminded of during a recent podcast that I watched with Paul Williams and Hassan Spiker. He said it's a historical saying that the right want what the left want just a little bit later.
Yeah.
Right? So they're both the same.
Yeah. Look, and that comes back to the historical roots. Mm-hmm. You know, the other great division is they both believe in libertarian values like individualism, utility, and things like that. But what they disagree in, what they disagree on, is just the pace of change. Mm-hmm. And so, a lot of Enlightenment thinkers on the conservative side were against the revolution in Europe, in principle, because it was a revolution, because they believe the institutions and the traditions and the customs have served them well. But over time, this will morph more naturally. It's not that they're against change. They're against revolutionary change, disruptive change.
Rapid change.
Change
that now enforces and affects themselves.
Yeah, well, the thing is that challenges their traditions. Now, if the tradition itself, the people themselves decide collectively over time to alter, which they do, they have no problem with that in principle. But it's been the feeling that they're being forced by some external force to move in that direction, which is the whole point of the Trump supporters. They regard Democrats and liberal politics to be an affront to their conservative values, and they're completely disrupting the family, disrupting what they believe naturalized gender roles, and other considerations. They feel that this is something being forced. This is not something natural. Now, if anyone knows anything about the Bible Belt in America, there is no correlation between their pastors and their churches and institutions and actual Christian values. You know, they've caught up in one scandal after another. The same in the British tradition. So it's not against, they're not against in principle notions of individualism and libertarian values. It's just they disagree over the speed and the manner in which that change should occur.
Yeah, it's happening. It's because at the end of the day, right, they've voted in great numbers for certain changes to family laws and that kind of stuff, both in Australia, America, and Britain, for instance, right? And yeah, it's only because it's been pushed a little bit too far now. They feel like
yeah.
it's it's being imposed into their own bedrooms.
That's right.
That they're now going, hell, hang on.
That's right. There's a certain that's not what I voted for. Now,
yeah.
For a long time, you know, those on the conservative side of politics, which is the natural resting place of power in Western societies, from time to time, the lefts are brought in. If you remember, again, we're revealing a bit too much about ourselves, yeah. The Hawke Keating era in this country, where they were brought in to undertake macroeconomic changes that made even the conservatives blush. You know, they did more. But this was a trend.
It was a trend around the world.
This was a trend around the world, because it brings us to the point that you raised, that there's a feeling that my values are under threat. But often we feel, where did this come from? All of a sudden now that we feel threatened. And when we think about it, we take a step back and we think about it and say, okay, what exactly are you complaining about here? You know, is the gender roles, as if the male population in Western societies are such glowing role models, you know, as if there's no, I don't want to get into the details, right? As if there's no problems with the way that males conduct themselves in Western societies and the institutions they built to support that. But why all of a sudden? And I think this is the point, right? We described Hawke and Keating, it's like the 80s with Thatcher in Britain, Reagan in America, that period where you would describe it as the almost near comprehensive victory of neoliberal politics. Mm-hmm. And those notions that developed from that globalization, neoliberalism, world trade, the reduction of tariffs, everything being defined primarily around economic value and things like that. Even the way we look at our Islam, but that's another conversation.
Even like the abolition of slavery had an economic tinge to it as well.
That's right. That's right.
And so what we're seeing of change, usually those that are really in power, the capitalists, that ultimately hold the powers of decision to enforce it, will only do it if there's a benefit for them.
Correct. Which is why I posit the question, is the agitation real? Mm. Is this intensity that we imagine, that they're about to kill each other, they're going to go at each other's throats, that they hate each other so much, is that real?
Well, I think it's quite easily for them to change the mood. Is it temperate overnight?
Yep.
Like we've seen on the War on Terror.
War on Terror.
Like we've seen with many other factors. Now we're actually seeing it a little bit now, right? Because if we take the World Cup as an example, the male World Cup,
yep,
was all about the pride.
That's right. Uproar globally.
The female, even though they have a lot more within the ranks. Right? Right? Not a word about it.
Nothing.
Not a word about it.
Opposite acquiescence.
Yes, 100%.
They were very diplomatic, even though it was being held in Australia. Very diplomatic. Yes. Whereas the world roared in the
And so the point is that it's a political decision.
100%.
It's political. And if they want to change the tide at any particular point in time, if it's in its interest, they can do that.
And this explains the other trend in Western societies, the emergence of what's come to be known as identity politics. You know, this gradual withering and fragmentation of Western societies, in the theory they call it the atomization of society. But basically, you go from one monolith, and then you gradually start to fragment yourself into various groupings on various levels, whether it's around race or gender or class or a million other categories. And these categories are infinite in number. And so every day we start to identify ourselves with another category. And so we become part of a smaller circle. And this has no end. And this is great for capitalists.
It's like sectarianism back in our homelands. What better way to distract the population and to divide them?
Yep.
It's to set one sect against
other. Our example, for instance, we come from what's come to be known as the Lebanese tradition, that it's not even enough to call yourself Sunni anymore. No. It's a particular type. And then every year or two, it gets further subdivided.
And the British and the French did other lines. Such a great job in dividing
they
Lebanon.
Were up against the whole population. Mm-hmm. And now, 80 years later, there is no resistance. Mm-hmm. And the opposite happens. That we actually put the resistance to Western occupation or Western colonization, however you call it, we put that on the back burner. And we start to center what we regard as our overriding considerations, now defined differently. around race or around gender or around sexuality or around anything. You know, our family role, our gender roles, the colors of the paint that we like. There's a million other versions of fragmentation. Tactic,
even Pharaoh himself, as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, that he separated his society into sex to and rule that, over them.
And that explains the intensity of the hatred. Whilst there are underlying currents and historical roots, the passion, the intensity, it's like watching theater from the outside. It's like a circus. There is no way that the political events and their intensity and their significance can be explained by one color or another. Like, absolutely, it does not make sense. But because there's so much noise, we get caught up in it. We think we got to take a position, that we have to take a side, that there is, we have to navigate this space because it's so existential for us. And it's like, hold on a minute. To give a very clear example, what's the celebration here? You know, if historically only men went and were sent to kill Muslims overseas, but now we're celebrating that women can go and kill Muslims too in the army, or only straight used to be able to, you know, go and kill Muslims overseas, but now people of all genders and sexualities and perspectives can. What's the celebration here? Because what's being ignored conveniently is the fact that this military intervention is still happening.
It's happening.
That the capitalists are still sucking us all around the world and squeezing us and robbing us all.
And they're laughing all the way to the bank.
And they're laughing all the way to the bank. And this is the point that we miss as Muslims, that because we get caught up and we feel that we have to, or it's so noisy and overwhelming that we get forced down this path without realizing, because we don't have a politics to begin with. We haven't taken a position on things to begin with. We don't have independent thought or an independent political agenda. We just get caught up like you described. There's Muslims all over, Muslims who are close to government, that all of a sudden they're organizing propaganda pieces for the yes referendum. It's not just a piece that...
It's just being taken along for the ride. Let's look at it
from a Muslim perspective. They're handing out government-sponsored literature and they're just used as propaganda pieces for the government. Like, how's that a politics by any measure, or a noble or a principled politics? And so this whole left-right divide, because the same characters, let's put it more accurately, the same dynamics and the same thinking that drove us to democratic Islam, that drove us to support the good-bad Muslim divide in the war on terror, it's the same dynamics being played out, the same thinking that's pushed us to the left and the right, and now to the yes and the no in the vote.
Yes, 100%. So I suppose we've established that there is some kind of historic philosophical route to all the trends that we're seeing, but there's also, and I would argue more so, a political motivation behind it, some kind of benefit behind it, which is pushed through the capitalists. The Muslims are getting caught up in it. So let's talk about the Muslim response then. What should we be doing, right? Should we be taking sides? Obviously, we have established that we shouldn't be taking sides.
Yeah.
But to return back to Islam, is to take a step back. If we can just understand what the purpose of a Muslim is, and as Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has described, that our purpose is to worship Him, but also the Islamic objective is to make Islam prevail over all other ways of life.
Yeah, I'm taking a deep breath because it hurts the heart. Because we talk about something so valuable and so sacrosanct for us as Muslims, preserving the integrity of Islam, our pristine understanding of it, and how even those expressions, traditional Islam, Orthodox Islam, have come to be so bastardized today, that proponents of traditionalism just always conveniently end up supporting conservative politics. Or those who propose an apolitical view of Islam always end up in the pocket of politicians. So in principle, 100% the starting point is what you say. Go back, learn our Islam. Go back, anchor yourself in Islam. But with the proviso that you understand the reality in which you live today. Because often what happens, a lot of us, and this is true for individuals, true for ulama, true for even Islamic movements, who go and believe they are under, learning or expressing or practicing an orthodox Islam or a traditional or classical Islam.
That's very passive.
But the reality is the opposite.
It's passive, it's irrelevant.
Passive, it's impotent,
in the global
it's apolitical,
geopolitical context.
Well, meaning they've been victim to the secularization of Islam, meaning they look at Islam, they study Islam, they approach Islam through a secular lens.
And so it's a very bizarre. Individualistic type of Islam.
Very individualistic, so very apolitical.
If it's comfortable with the current secular system.
As all other religions, Christianity has been remodeled, Judaism has been remodeled, all other religions have been remodeled, and all other philosophies have been remodeled to fit comfortably within the secular lens, to fit under in the hierarchy of secular institutions. And so religious institutions and religious practice fall under that. But having said that, it's not as if we can't escape. It's just, one, we need to be aware of the forces that impose themselves over us, understand those forces, but at the same time, take a position on them Islamically. For instance, in Hizb ut-Tahrir, we cover a lot of stuff, for instance, right, in our literature. We talk about statehood, we talk about modernity, we talk about ideologies, we talk about a whole host of things. Even rationalism, you know, we define thinking, we enter the conversation around ilm al-kalam and things like that, but we took an independent position on those things that was informed exclusively through the Islamic lens. And that's the important difference, that you have an usul, get yourself an usul if you don't have it, you have an usul that's grounded in traditionalism, and you apply that
investigate the reality,
understand the reality, because a lot of religious figures and religious bodies purport to understand something and take a position on something, but when you scratch the surface you realize there's not much there.
I like the example that Islam is democracy.
Islam is democracy, or Islam is, I don't want to get any examples,
because it
just hurts the heart.
There was Islam or socialism as well before that.
Yeah, before that.
Yes.
During the Cold War. The idea of...
Especially because the socialists were seen as anti-imperialist.
That's right.
Islam,
that's right,
is for that as well.
That's right. So it's taken an independent position on it, but one that's framed exclusively through an Islamic lens. Now, the question becomes, where do you get that from? You go to Islamic universities today,
it's not there,
and they're controlled by tyrannical governments.
Just slaves of the...
You try to learn it in Western societies, and the educational institutions are funded by Australian government, by Western governments, that force a secular view of things. So where do you get it?
I think it's there, right? Meaning, that no matter what you learn from these Islamic universities, at the end of the day, you're still going back to the Quran and the Sunnah.
It's not going to change the essence.
So the person really just takes himself out of that institution just a little bit. Like, grab the stuff that he learned, right? But really analyze the text, right? Even a young child can really, really see what the essence of the texts are.
It is.
Right? So it's not calling... It's not calling...
Look, there's a certain fitra...
For a coexistence of Islam with kufr.
Look, there's a certain fitra around the nature of Islam that every Muslim can access. You know, basic things. Aqidah, you know, iman, kufr, halal, haram. Look, we know the essence. Even if the opposite is shouted 1,000 times, we know the essence. Halal is always going to be halal. Haram is always going to be haram. You know, iman is always going to be iman. Kufr is always going to be kufr. So in essence, it's accessible as long as we get it in its pristine form. The other side, of course, is to do your best to access knowledge from scholars who are not in proximity to governments of all backgrounds, in the Muslim world or the Western world. It's a very, very simple rule. Anyone, institution, individual, scholar or otherwise, that is in proximity, and that's on various shades, but in proximity, at any point, it's too close to the government, their existence dependent on government, their funding is funneled through the government, their position is dependent upon the patronage of government, etc., etc., or their overriding politics is built around the approval of these governments in the Western world or the Muslim world, right? Put an X.
Right, even in the Islamic tradition, even under Islam,
scholars warn
the scholars that go to the doorsteps, that actually go to the doorsteps of the rulers.
That's right. And so there is a great body of Islamic scholarship, and there are great Islamic organizations that not only are not in proximity to government, but in fact are challenging and in conflict with government for Islamic reasons. And that's important too. It's not built around benefit or anything like that.
And it's important because it protects the independence of thinking.
100%.
The autonomy in thinking.
100%. And that's something that should be a life and death issue for us Muslims. Just to preserve the integrity of Islam, to preserve the pristine, clear understanding of Islam, you can't put a value on that. Because for us as Muslims, what else do we have to rest on? We don't have power at the moment. We don't have armies behind us. We don't have governments behind us. We don't have economy behind us. What else do we have except a crystal clear understanding of Islam that gives us conviction, confidence, and understanding, gives us a reason to get up in the morning, like you describe, proactive, is universal in its view of the world, enlarges the view of a Muslim, gives them the confidence, understands the world is their platform, removes this minority thinking, removes this defeatist attitude where I have to conform with what's in front of me, whether it's left or right or good or bad Muslim or any other variation of that.
And in that, the rest of society can then see Islam as a true alternative, not just another religion that sits within the confines of the dominating
political system. That's fallen like all other religions before them have fallen before secular institutions. What other hope is there? We describe both left and right are antithetical to human values, to the human condition. They both are rooted in colonialism. They are both entrenched in racism, the rooted in racism. The whole notion of modern statehood is built on that. And they both perpetuate the policies that sustain all of that. So why would I subscribe to that as a Muslim? Why would I accept to position myself, underneath that hierarchy and become subordinate and subservient to that? Why would I do that as a Muslim when I have something so more transcendent, something especially, from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
As you were saying, the history is so dark.
That's right.
The history is so dark.
And the divides that we witness, the fact that there's a lot of noise means people are complaining, but no one has a solution. There's no resolution to these things. This has been going on for centuries in Western societies. And if they can't turn to the Muslims, and if we can't present ourselves in a very unique space where we offer very unique perspectives that transcends all the rubbish that we see in front of us, then what's the point of us? Like, how much of a crime would it be if not only were we to misrepresent our Islam or accept to bastardize our Islam, but we failed to give what humanity so desperately needs today?
100%, which is what the essence of Islam is, right? It's to bring humanity out of the darkness of worshipping the creation into the light of worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. That's our noble objective. And may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala
take very seriously.
Yeah, 100%. And we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to make it easier upon the Muslims to really fulfill the responsibility, the weighty responsibility that has been placed upon the shoulders of the one that accepted the message. It's not because we have some kind of ego trip that we want to try and enforce our opinions or our life upon other people. For us, it's not even a right, it's a command upon us. It's not like we have a choice to do it or not. And yet, the sincerity shines through every Muslim because he knows that it's his responsibility to also bring other people along with him. And so upon that, it's a very interesting discussion, the whole history of left and right.
And an ongoing one. And inshallah, I hope Muslims take a more esteemed view of themselves so they can offer something more transcendent and more proactive and something so much more beneficial than what we've seen historically, inshallah.
JazakAllah khair. And so with that, we'll just end the discussion here. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.